You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, conversations with the icons of our time.
I definitely get chided by people who think that I ought to stick to one thing and just do that. And I don't like doing that. I like being all over the place.
Author Neil Gaiman. Today on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm Bill Thompson. British-born Neil Gaiman is nothing if not prolific and versatile. His fiction includes novels, novellas, short stories, poetry, even screenplays, graphic novels, and comic books. And his fiction has won a virtual trophy case full of major awards. As a child, Neil Gaiman started reading when he was 4, and then devoured books all through his childhood. I first met him in the fall of 2006 when he published a book of short stories called Fragile Things. So here now, from 2006, Neil Gaiman.
It's short stories, but it's also a few poems. It's a novella. It's a collection of, as the thing, short fictions.
Yes, short fictions and illusions. The last one, Smoke and Mirrors, was short fictions and illusions. This one is short fictions and wonders. And yes, there's a novella in there. There are some poems. There are a few oddments. I think there's 31, possibly 32 if you count a hidden bit of a short story in the introduction. Bits of various description in the book.
But now that you've told us it's in the introduction, it's no longer hidden.
I assume that any readers who actually would listen to this as a podcast or go and find it are actually going to be the kind of jolly good sorts that would actually read an introduction and would find it for themselves.
Well, we should tell people this is not the kind of introduction I want to thank my Aunt Millie and my dog Spot. This is the kind of introduction I wish more writers would put in which you explain the origins of these stories.
Well, it seemed like a nice, sensible way to do it. I talk a little bit about what I like to do as a short story writer, writing short fiction, and then I talk about something about each of the pieces, whether it's who commissioned it and how it came about, or sometimes it's the idea that propelled it. There's one story in there that I did the first draft of when I was 22, and the second draft when I was 40, And I tell that story and how it happened.
Indeed, maybe that's instructive for our young writers among us, that you don't always publish within the same week that you write something.
Absolutely not. I actually used to think, I remember I got to the end of the year 2002 and felt like I hadn't done very much, because all I'd done was some short stories and little things here and there. There was a lot of that kind of thing in 2002. And it was only really sort of 3-4 years later, looking back on that year and realizing that the 4 short stories I wrote, which were then published, just because of the weirdness of publishing history over the next 3 or 4 years, all collected either the Locus Award for Best Short Story, one of them got the Hugo Award for Best Short Story. I mean, there was tremendous body of cool short storiness and award-winningness, which I actually at the time thought, oh, I really haven't done much this year, just did a lot of short stuff. So,
I do find it fascinating that there seem to be some reviewers who invariably will give you the 5 stars of the review, but they think, he writes whatever he wants. Why, we never know quite where it's going to go. As though you're supposed to pick a genre, write only in that genre, and never stray.
I can't figure that one out myself. I don't know any human being who only enjoys one kind of fiction. I've never met somebody who says, I only watch pirate movies. I will watch nothing but pirate movies. I will read nothing but pirate books. I want nothing else. Maybe I'd watch a comedy if it was a pirate comedy, but it's pirates all the way, or it's nurse fiction all the way, or whatever. And yet, I definitely get chided. Or is that chid? By people who think that I ought to stick to one thing and just do that. And I don't like doing that. I like being all over the place. I'm very happy to be able to do things that I suppose if you define fantasy as widely as possible, you have to make a very, very broad definition of fantasy. It's probably mostly fantasy. But beyond that, you know, you're on your own, really. And actually in there, there are some oddments. There's one short story that I wrote for the Matrix website before they released the Matrix movie. And they just said, would I do a short story set around the world of the Matrix? And I thought about it and did them a story called Goliath. And so I put that in there. I put I did a Sherlock Holmes story. And that's in there. I did several stories that are practically mainstream fiction. And I also got to do a retelling of the battle between Beowulf and Grendel set in a Scottish estate in the far north of Scotland. So it's all sorts of stuff.
With some haunted houses along the way and some dreams along the way and some visitors from other worlds along the way that will satisfy all those who need visitors from other worlds and haunted houses and that, but also a couple of stories that just seemed just very ordinary. I mean, just regular people doing regular things.
Oh, I think that you should be allowed to tell stories. And the joy of a short story is if you get to the end and you go, that was a nice short story, and it wasn't like anything else I've read. When I did my first short story collection, Smoke and Mirrors, the reviews, to be honest, were very, very uniform. All of the reviewers said that there were stories that were amazing, world-class, and carried the collection, and then there were stories that were practically embarrassing and I shouldn't have published. Had there been any agreement from reviewer to reviewer on which stories were which, I could have learned something from this. I could have taken something from this. It would have perhaps changed this collection. As it is, all I wound up learning was that different people like different things, and I'm not going to please everybody, so I may as well please myself. And that was my philosophy.
Well, in the early audience reaction to this book, are there any stories in particular that people are coming, do you have a top three that people are coming up to you and say, whoa, I love that story?
No. There really, really isn't. I guess I know that people love A Study in Emerald, the Sherlock Holmes / H.P. Lovecraft story, because it's evil and it does some clever things and it makes people happy. And it won the Hugo Award and several other awards, and it was in most of the year's best anthologies. So I can be pretty sure that it worked and people like it. But really, no, the reviews, it's been exactly the same. I think of the 31 pieces, I must have seen about 11 or 12 picked out by people as their favorite or clearly the best.
If you're keeping a tally, I will vote for How to Talk to Girls.
How to Talk to Girls at Parties is probably, I think, my favorite short story in there. Partly because I don't quite know where it came from. And I think that's, for me, the joy of the best short stories are the ones where I know sort of what I was thinking when I went off to write it. And I know that most of it turned up in the title. And I had this sort of idea suddenly about the gulf between boys and girls, and wouldn't it be interesting if instead of being unable to talk to girls, I had my 15-year-old, couple of 15-year-old boys, or one in particular, the narrator, who failed to notice that the girls at the party that he was at were aliens from another cosmos, each from a different place and stuff, because he's not really listening, he's not really talking, he's just desperate to try and get off with them and failing miserably. So that for me was one of the, it was such an enormous delight to write it. I wrote it very, very fast, and it seemed while I was writing it to be saying something very important about the gulf between the sexes, and afterwards I thought, well, no, it's not really, it's just talking about people and how they communicate.
After the short break, Neil Gaiman explains how sometimes it takes just luck to make a short story.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 2006 conversation with Neil Gaiman.
Actually, in your introduction, you did mention, and forgive me, I don't remember which story it was that you referred to, that the initially you had just the first, the seed of the idea, and then the rest of it, you were almost the kind of court stenographer, just taking down what the characters were saying.
Oh, yeah, that was a story called Harlequin Valentine, and I remember writing the first sentence. I didn't really have a plot. I just had the idea that I wanted a day in the life of Harlequin, and I was going to bring Harlequin from the Harlequinades of the 19th century into a very, very peculiar kind of late 20th, early 21st century America, because it's obviously not really even set in America, and yet it is. It's very odd. Everybody's walking everywhere. Nobody walks in America. Or not in the parts that it's set. So, but they had to walk, because that was how the story worked. I remember coming up with the first sentence, writing that down, and everything else might as well have been automatic writing. But you don't get many of them. That's the other thing. If you write enough short stories and you write enough short fiction, sometimes the gods will be nice to you and they will toss you a crumb or they will be kind. And sometimes, I say in the introduction, talking about the story study in Emerald, sometimes you just get lucky. It's like, you know, you can have made a cake or a recipe for something a dozen times and then you think, oh, well, I'll just try adding these things, and you make something and everybody who tastes it says, oh my gosh, this is amazing. How did you do this? And you're not quite sure. It's just that recipe turned out better than it ever had any right to. And perhaps the next time you try it, the cake won't rise.
And you may have started that day with the same 26 ingredients and some punctuation that everybody else has available to them. But the alchemy of bringing those letters and punctuation marks together, I still don't understand how you do it.
Oh, you're much too kind. You're not going to get any explanation of how I do it. And partly the thing about short fiction, at novel length, I can probably explain how I do things. Because novels mostly are like digging ditches. You get up every morning and you're just going to have to dig that ditch across the field. And if it's good day digging, it's a good day. And if it's a bad day, it's a bad day. But you're going to have to get to the end of the field and it's going to take you a certain amount of time. Whereas making a short story, or even, you know, there's a few poems in there, and doing successful poems is probably more like casting a clay pot or something. You throw that clay down and very shortly after, you either have something absolutely beautiful or you have the kind of lumpy thing that you used to take home as a kid and only your grandmother would be polite about.
We had a lot of those ashtrays around my house.
Exactly. Yes, they always used to call them ashtrays. But then people would never use them as ashtrays because if you stumped out cigarettes in them, it would be really icky. So they keep old buttons and small defunct batteries for some reason. People keep defunct batteries in them.
Rolls of film that haven't been taken to the drugstore yet.
Exactly.
Is there a finer line than we sometimes realize between what makes you laugh and what makes you horrified and what makes you transported to a different world? I mean, are those lines more easily blurred, you think, than we give people credit for?
Well, they blur in real life. You know, I'm always fascinated by the blurring of genre and of emotion in real life. You know, there's one moment you are sitting mourning a dead friend, and then you look up and you watch a waiter perform a perfectly executed pratfall, sending an arc of liquid from his tray over some poor diners, and it's the funniest thing you've ever seen. And that occurs within the space of 5 seconds, and both things are true. Neither thing is less true than the other. And I often get the impression that one is expected to pick. And you don't have to pick in life. I always love humor. Humor is a wonderful thing. It evokes an immediate reaction from people, and it's a delight. By the same token, horror evokes an immediate reaction and a physical reaction. People read horror and there's that prickling on the back of their neck. Their skin creeps. It's really cool. And by the same token, I love stuff that actually, if it works, creates a real sense of awe. And again, that you get that sort of feeling that you're reading something, you're in the presence of the numinous, you're something special and magical is happening because you have read this sentence and you aren't the same person you were the sentence before. And how often one actually achieves that as a writer, I don't know, but that's sort of what you're always going for, I think. One of the metaphor that runs through the introduction is that the title, Fragile Things, the things that we think of as being fragile tend not to be. You know, butterflies' wings are fragile, yet you have the idea of the butterfly effect where one butterfly somewhere is going to create a storm. Eggs are fragile, yet you can actually do cool tricks where you stand on a couple of eggs and they don't break because you distribute the weight properly. Snowflakes individually are tiny, fragile things, yet they can crush villages en masse. And the human heart is an incredibly fragile thing, and yet it will pump for a lifetime. And I love the fact that our cover is this semi-transparent, sort of translucent paper that looks like it would fall apart. And it's, and I've been assured by my publisher incredibly happily that rather to their surprise, it seems tougher than the normal run of dust jackets. So the metaphor holds.
Neil Gaiman is 63. He lives in Wisconsin and Massachusetts. Now you can get a copy of Fragile Things by Neil Gaiman by tapping the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. We may earn an Amazon commission if you make a purchase. Heardeverything.com is where you can also find my 2002 interview with another well-known author with quite a following, Salman Rushdie.
One of the things that I think people stopped saying about my writing at the point at which the Iranian threats emerged, you know, is that a lot of it is comic, you know. And one of the things not often said about the Satanic Verses is that it's in large part a funny novel.
And my 2005 conversation with the author of Wicked, Gregory Maguire.
Now, some people have said of Wicked, Mr. Maguire is not a very good novelist because he doesn't answer all the questions. And we get to the end of the book and we have lots of questions. He doesn't know how to wrap up a novel. But in fact, Wicked was a tragedy.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, a close-up and personal look at what it's like to go from a small-town kid in Massachusetts to one of the world's most notorious drug kingpins. My 1993 conversation with drug smuggler George Jung.
The whole time I was incarcerated, waiting to be sentenced, I was planning to get back in the marijuana business. When he said, "Have you ever heard of cocaine?" You know, I said, "Well, tell me about it."
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.